Welcome to Stories from the Park, a Heritage Park podcast.
Hi, I'm Kasiah Quill, Chief Curator at Heritage Park.
And I'm Dominic Terry, Communications Manager.
We are located on Treaty 7 land in Calgary, Alberta, a place where visitors come to learn about the history of all those who have gathered here, and where Indigenous people proudly share their cultural traditions and tell stories about their rich heritage, history, and attachment to the land.
The history of queer people in Western Canada is our focus for this episode. The early recorded history of the movement, where they lived, and more importantly, where they learned to stay away from. As well as dig into some of the hard-to-find stories of what it was like to be queer in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Our guest is Candace Klein, whose research fields include queer, gender, legal, and Indigenous histories in Western Canada. Candace is a PhD candidate at the University of Saskatchewan. Just a warning, this episode may contain mature subject matter.
Hi, Candace. Thanks for doing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming to share your knowledge with us.
Yeah, I'll impart what wisdom I can.
I guess, Candace, we'll just start off by, probably tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this kind of research and what you're focusing on these days.
For sure. So I'm a PhD candidate. I'm finishing up in the last few months of my PhD at the University of Saskatchewan. It's funny. So my actual specialty really veered away from what my original plans were for my PhD. So I was wanting to do queer history and do queer history of Saskatchewan and Alberta and sort of late 19th, early 20th century. And so I get to the archives and I'm looking at a lot of jail records and that sort of thing. And I keep on seeing different charges over and over again, one of them being incest. And so I became really interested in what looked like hundreds of charges of incest in Saskatchewan, and I actually totally pivoted. So now my work actually looks at the history of incest in Saskatchewan from 1900 to 1930.
Wow.
Which is a total
crazy topic. Wow.
Totally. Yeah. So it's been absolutely wild to work on the last few years. It's pretty dark and difficult history, but I've been able to do it.
Awesome.
And it's interesting. So I do legal history, I would say, is definitely more my specialty, but I still work also in queer history. I do lots of research assistance with queer histories. And I also was working with and helping to curate our queer history collection at the University of Saskatchewan. It's the Richards Collection for Gender and Sexual Diversity. And it is, I think, one of our largest queer history archive in Canada. It actually rivals the queer archives in Ontario, and I think it kind of supersedes it, to be honest, but there's not a lot of publicity around it and a lot of people don't know about it. So I've been working with people there, especially Anne Lang and Lindsay Stokalko, and we've been trying to get that collection out there and get people aware of it and let alone be able to use it. So I sort of wear very two different hats. I have for my PhD research itself is this legal history, a history of sex crimes. And then in my teaching and in my research in my other jobs, it's all queer history. So it's an interesting blend.
Yeah, this kind of almost naturally come from each other.
Yeah,
absolutely. So what are some of the challenges that you face when we do queer history research?
Well, there's so many because, so first of all, even at the university level, even at the bureaucratic level, there are massive challenges because if you're dealing with living subjects, for example, mm-hmm. you have to go through this very large ethics process and ethics review board, which is not geared towards humanities. It's certainly not geared towards oral history. And quite often, those are very harm-causing institutions and actually quite homophobic. Some of the things that I've been asked to do on projects, things I've had to personally disclose to the ethics board that I actually didn't feel comfortable necessarily exposing to them in order just to say, yeah, you can interview a bunch of women. a lot of the harm that that ethics board assumes will happen just because you're talking about queer history and experiences. A lot of it is actually so homophobic, and it's really frustrating at that bureaucratic red tape level, even before you start the process of interviewing people. So that is in itself a challenge, is the ethics board. I don't know if I'm like allowed to say that, but honestly, the ethics board is very at institutions are some of my biggest issues in that. So that's definitely one of the main issues. And then also when you're researching live people, so say if you're doing, you know, if you're interviewing, say, like in my master's thesis, I interviewed a bunch of lesbian women in Vancouver. And, you know, with oral histories and living subjects, you know, there's this sort of sharing of information and this sort of sharing of authorship in a way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there will be people, and you have to show them, at least in my own ethics, to show them what it is I'm writing about them for that thesis. And they had to read it and let me know what they liked and what they didn't. And there's things that I had to pull, and there's stuff that I wasn't allowed to put on record, which really would have, I think, helped flesh it out a bit, would have really helped some of these questions that people had for me after it had been published. You know, and it was like, I'm unfortunately have that answer, but cannot answer it because of these living subjects that I have to honor in my work. So, that can be a little bit difficult for sure when you're talking, not just even queer subjects, but living subjects in general, like that sort of blend.
Yeah. I think that leads nicely into a different kind of into a different question of, you know, if you can't explain it in a fulsome way, then what are some of the misconceptions that are had about queer history in Western Canada?
For sure. There can be. So one of the things that happens a lot, not in Saskatoon, I will say, but something that happens a lot in Vancouver, is women fight a lot. Queer people are sort of fighting so much, and then there becomes, you know, some people want some of those fights disclosed, some people don't, and it can kind of almost skew what's actually happening with that infighting, especially when you're dealing with lesbian women and heterosexual women fighting about certain things and events happening. You know, people have very real and hurt feelings, and sometimes it can sort of have some, you know, cloudiness of the quote unquote truth of what happened. You know, it can kind of creates these holes in the work, so to speak, and people can kind of fill in those blanks themselves, and it might be accurate, it might not be, but I can't really clarify that, you know? And then in terms of, you know, one of the huge issues with queer history is when we're talking about people who are no longer here, we're talking about queer history from a very much more distant past. You know, we have things that have been totally forgotten or destroyed or completely hidden or written about incorrectly and things. Like, there's just, I think with queer history, there's so much potential for things to sort of be skewed or hidden. And that's one of like those difficult things that even, yeah, just sort of allowing for full disclosure of events and things might actually shed lights on that situation, but it'll never come to light because those people don't ever want to talk about it.
Right. You're kind of alluding to earlier periods of Western Canadian history, and I'm curious, is there some opportunities for freedom for some people to come to Western Canada in this early period who are queer? Is there something that might have drawn them here and offered them that freedom?
Yeah, so it's interesting because there's I would say that, you know, there's no black and white answer to that, but because a lot of people don't realize this, but people in Saskatchewan especially, in some part Alberta, were under almost heavier surveillance than they would have been in Ontario, because of the Northwest Mounted Police, because of the large Indigenous populations out here. These provinces were really heavily policed in ways that weren't done in the East. British Columbia is a little bit different just because of some of the terrain made it physically impossible to police the same way.
Right.
You also have this real influx of men into British Columbia, for example, especially in the southeastern and middle parts of that province that are so male centric and male populated that it just becomes it's almost homoerotic in the way that men write about each other and the way that men speak about each other, even if they're themselves not gay subjects. It's almost hard to discern like what would actually be erotic versus non-erotic relationships between men in there. But yeah, I think that some people could find freedom in certain ways, especially in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Once the 1910s and 20s, basically with the advent of World War I, that's when it becomes really difficult and you see this real switch. But I'd say pre-World War I, there were quite a few queer people here. And then especially when we look at Indigenous histories, I mean, queer and two-spirit people had been here since time immemorial. And in fact, you look at colonial records, and almost every single colonial record includes queer Indigenous peoples. Almost every colonial person was commenting on it. So clearly it was something that was here beforehand, so of course settlers would follow suit with their sexuality. I mean, that's kind of how settlement happens, is they follow these Indigenous foundations, and so why wouldn't sexuality be a part of that?
Yeah. So I wanted to go down that road of the way that men used to talk about other men, and is that a language thing? Is that the way that men would look at each other in that time period as, wow, he's really strong, or wow, he's a really good navigator, or and the way that the language that they use to describe that, or is it more overt than that?
I think it can be both, depending on what kind of record you're looking at and who you're looking at and the space. So for example, in the late 1800s in Victoria and Esquimalt, for example, where you have the Navy base that's been established there for a long time, sex and desire was so common that it actually became like extremely prohibited really early on in that Navy's history, and in fact became incredibly violent for people that dare skirted out there. There are men that had been shot and killed by other men because of advances and things like that. So it was really so for example, Esquimalt and the Navy base were actually really dangerous for gay men. But you could go to the port of Vancouver, or you could go further east into the interior, and it was like a much safer space. And you see the writing sort of change around that, and a little bit more like admiration based, or describing the muscular body of the captain, or, really having in various like journals and diaries of men that could actually write, which was kind of rare at the time, but for men that could, for sure, there seemed to be something a little bit more to their admiration than just, but it's similar when you look at women writing about their best friends, as they say, oh, they were just roommates for 20 years. They're writing to each other about how, they missed one's bosom and sharing a bed and whispering sweet nothings, twining fingers through their hair, and you're like, yeah, no, that's just totally something that friends write. That's my favorite, actually. But yeah, like it's undeniable at the very least that these relationships were intimate. And you can't necessarily use present day terms or ideas around sex and love to examine the past. That's not going to be historically accurate. However, I think we can talk about human condition and experience of intimacy and desire and sexuality and feelings, that those all existed. People weren't robots in the late 1800s. And so when you have this constant repetition of very sexual, very intimate writings between people of the same sex over and over and over again, there's something more to that. But there's always such a heavy onus on us as queer historians to prove that, in fact, they were queer, and there has to be at least photographic evidence or something. And it's like, well, that's not possible.
Right. So. Yeah, that's kind of some of the challenges that you face. It's not easy to necessarily prove or disprove anything.
For sure. for yeah. sure.
So curious that obviously there are communities of people that are queer throughout Western Canada, but how are they finding each other and finding relationships with each other or even just community to form?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on the time period. So, you know, like what kinds of time periods are you sort of thinking, or like, do you want me to go through the time periods?
Yeah, I'm thinking kind of pre-1930. How are people, finding each other? Kind of earlier. Because the time periods we address at the park most deeply is 1910, and then prior to the railway arriving is the other period we talked about.
And then you also talked about like different places that they would be. So obviously they wouldn't go to Esquimalt. They would, you know, I guess you can
don't go to the Navy. Don't go to
tie that all together as to how they would find themselves and if there were places that they would go that they knew were kind of.
For sure. So definitely, you know, cruising as we call it now, but there would be code essentially. So, you know, like you could put your, like a certain color of pocket square whilst you're walking the park late at night and long glances and things. You know, Oscar Wilde really helped. Oscar Wilde was really a part of people's imagination in the prairies. In fact, in 1895, I believe, there is a trial with a Regina merchant. He is of the merchant class. He's very well respected. And they call him Regina's Oscar Wilde because he's discovered having sex with two men that were, you know, they're young men. And so he's caught. There were witnesses. They described in full detail using the butter bucket for lubrication and things. It's all in the Leader Post. And it's so interesting because they don't explain who Oscar Wilde is, but they say Regina's Oscar Wilde and caught an indecent act. So clearly the literate public understands who Oscar Wilde is, and he was on trial for indecent acts, very similar, right? So he's very much a part of the consciousness. And so Frank Hoskins was the name of the gentleman who was Regina's Oscar Wilde. So while I'm not sure exactly how he met his two lovers, I think it was through the bar scene actually, and took them home. And then the two young men who he took back to his store, essentially, those guys, their friends tagged along and watched them through this window. And they watched them do it several nights. So, you know, there's also an interesting case to be made about those friends maybe being interested, or at the very least kind of having these voyeuristic tendencies. So, you know, that's something that happened. And actually, speaking of Regina as well, and parts of Alberta, the Northwest Mounted Police, there were quite a few gay men in those ranks, so much so that they actually allowed sex workers to come and visit men in remote places. So say they would come to Fort McLeod, they go to Fort Walsh. There were actually traveling caravans of sex workers that would come in to spend time with those men because they thought it would help curb the homosexual sex happening, or same-sex sex, I should say, happening, that was so prevalent within the Northwest Mounted Police.
You're talking about women sex workers that they would bring.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Which, you know, was not allowed, but it was one of those necessary evils, quote unquote, you know, that was very so popular at the time, the way that government officials would sort of validate why they allowed certain, quote unquote, immoral things to occur. So because it was just such a problem, and so many had been discharged, including some higher ranking officers by that time, with throughout its establishment, really, once they come to Fort Walsh. So there's professions you can choose to find one another, but just simply walking through parks and cruising and word of mouth really is how people find one another. You kind of just know who your kind are almost, and can kind of use code, whether it's language, whether it's hanky code, where different colors and different pockets mean different desires and wants. So hanky code actually does come from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Something that also happens is that you find sex work and brothels specifically, where there will be male sex workers to service other men. And we see that, we have documentation of that in Winnipeg. We have documentation of that in Saskatoon, in Regina, in Edmonton, in Calgary. And I haven't read too much around Vancouver, but I assume if it's happening in Prairie Cities, it's also happening in Vancouver. So that's something that we see. There are a few instances of men being arrested as inmates of a common body house with their with people who had been paying for their services, sort of caught in the act.
Wow. Well, I will just note too that, like, you're talking about the case and writing about it in the newspaper, that newspapers in the past were actually a lot more explicit than a lot of people in the present would realize. Yeah. There's some, like, language I've seen about murders or deaths that are very, very graphic and descriptive in a way that we don't use that language anymore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty wild, because I have to read so many newspapers for my own work on incest, and it's pretty wild some of the things that they'll publish in detail in the newspaper where that would never happen today. And so, yeah, it's almost sort of like sort of this very descriptive entertainment for the readers. And it's really like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You know,
too much information for the average person, and it's just there. Yeah. Yeah. You were talking about a little bit about sex work and its ties into queer history. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so sex workers, and, you know, there's actually some really great work on San Francisco about this. And so Nana Miller-Boyd, I believe, is the historian that writes about that. But that actually can be extrapolated, we can see directly to Edmonton and Saskatoon. Similar things are happening in that. So sex workers, they establish brothels in certain areas, right? And it becomes this real geography of sex. So people know about these geographies of sex in cities and even rural spaces too, right? Where, you know, there's a certain amount of protection that is offered via the sexual geography. And especially because brothels are being run by people with deep pockets, or they're really tough individuals, or they have ties to the mob, which becomes really important in the early and mid 20th centuries for queer people, as well as sex workers. Ties to the mob become, like, pretty commonplace. So there are these geographies where people already know to expect some kind of illicit sex. And so people understanding that same sex behaviors and sexualities and desires kind of flock to these areas as well. And there becomes this sort of bi-directional protection for queer people and for sex workers. And they operate quite often in the same spaces because there's safety in numbers. Right. And quite often, and as we see with lesbians in the early to mid 1900s, lots of women, lesbian women do, you know, enter into the sex work trade. Sometimes their partners are their pimps, you know, and especially with that butch femme dynamic that was happening. And so there's historians that document that about Toronto and Montreal, but the same thing is happening in Saskatoon, in Edmonton, especially. So there's this, there's just this sort of connection in the sexual geography between sex work districts and queer districts. And sometimes they overlap with one another. There is a gentleman I was speaking with, I was kind of just doing oral history recordings with him. And so he was a young gay man. This is in the 50s and 60s when he would have been young, but he sort of felt like he found out he was gay through a sexual encounter with an older man in a public washroom. And he really enjoyed the experience, and he started doing sex work to have sex with other men. And that sort of, so for him, doing sex work and being gay as a young man were sort of one and the same and were hard to separate. And that seems to be something that was common for people, for some writings that we have that have survived over time. There's a link there. It doesn't mean that every sex worker is queer or every queer person is a sex worker. That's not what that means, but there just is a layover in terms of sexual geographies in the history they're in. They're kind of connected. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of queer people meeting, you know, once the 1920s and 30s happened, public washrooms really actually, especially park washrooms, really become sort of a staple of male and male sex and sexuality. So much so that actually in Regina at Wascana Park, there's a notorious gardener who was one of the gardeners in the park. And he, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, would actually sort of stake out the washrooms. And he wow. caught several men in the act because he was so on it. It was sort of like he was the washroom patrol guy. It was very, I was like, okay, sir, maybe tend to the garden, you know, but he was tending to a different garden. So
yeah, sure he is. you've given us a couple of real good examples there, especially your man in the leader post there. But do you have any kind of other specific stories? And I know that these things come up because of, you know, being charged with different crimes, that kind of thing. But do you have any other specific kind of stories from the prairies, you know, in that period, though, pre-World War II, pre-1905 period?
Right. Well, I mean, one of my favorite stories is actually 1942. So it's not that early, and I can get to some earlier experiences in a minute, but or maybe I'll start with some of the earlier ones. So I'll get to my favorite in a bit, but I would say the earlier experiences. So we actually see lots of what we would now call transgender individuals in the early 1900s in the prairies. Actually, in fact, in the West in general, what, you know, they called it cross-dressing, but it would be men dressed as women who lived their lives as women. It was so commonplace in the Western frontier in the 1800s that it almost like wasn't mentioned. The historian that wrote about that, it'll come to me. But anyway, there's a whole book about that. Yeah. And it was really, really similar in the prairies as well. Like, we see people living their lives as the gender that they prefer. And it's not until they are, that they die sometimes that their quote unquote true sex is discovered, right? Actually, Emily Skidmore wrote a great book about that, about the Midwest and that same kind of turn of the 20th century, the lives of trans men she writes about. But it was happening here too. And there's a whole bunch of newspaper clippings that I've found over the years in the early 1900s, you know, girl discovered living life as boy, or, you know, there's quite a few of true sex discovered when you look at, if you're trying to find sort of women and trans men in the record, they existed. They're living full lives, sometimes their entire lives, as they themselves felt inside. So when people talk about, you know, oh, transgender is this new modern thing. Well, no, it's not. It's been a part of the prairie story since its inception. And of course, looking at Indigenous histories, it's been a part of this land since this land existed. Two-spirit histories and queer and transgender histories for Indigenous peoples. So, you know, trans people have always existed here, and we have the stories to prove that through newspaper clippings even. You know, Sarah Carter wrote a really great article about Jack May, right? And sort of it's kind of debated, was Jack May trans? Were they lesbian? Were they gender nonconforming? Well, it doesn't necessarily matter, because Jack did sort of live their lives as a man in some ways, and kind of shows about gender boundaries and gender crossing, and how this is, you know, this is happening in 1916 in Alberta, 1912, 1916 Alberta. Mm-hmm. And Jack was very popular until they went back to England, it turns out, to follow a love interest, a female love interest. So those stories just are always, there's so many of them there. But I will say, like, one of my favorite stories, there's one of, it turns out, two women getting married in the 1930s in Regina, but it's just like a little clipping of that. So it was like, you know, lesbian wedding. Well, I didn't say lesbian, but, you know, girls wed in the 1930s in Regina, which was really cool. There's not too much else known about that. But in 1942, there are what's called the Edmonton homosexual ring bust. And it's a very interesting story. Lyle Dick's written a bit about it. And it is this group of men who were having sex with one another. Some of them were very much in love because there's some letters that are in the court case files at the Provincial Archives of Alberta. And they're writing these really beautiful letters to each other. And it's like, ugh, like it makes your heart, makes your heart strings go. But so they were a part, of course, a theater company. So we want to talk about queer meeting spaces. Well, they were at the Little Edmonton Theater, and it was all these men running this theater group, and they were pretty much all gay men. Some of them had wives, but some of them didn't actually. And they wasn't exactly sure how it got discovered initially, but essentially there was this big sting operation. And in this, in Edmonton, you know, 1930s and 40s, there was this series of like sexual moral panics, right? With that interwar period and gender norms really being destabilized, and the newspapers are really ramping up these sex crime perils and moral panics around this. And so they're set up this total dragnet operation to nab these men from the Edmonton Little Theatre Company. And so it's basically this large trial, and something like, I think it's 11 of them or something, essentially go through the whole thing. Yeah. One guy is sent to Prince Albert Penitentiary for 3 years for what is very consensual sex between men. But it really was during, it was sort of at the wrong place at the wrong time, because it was caught up in this larger moral panic that was happening in Edmonton, where sex, where a sex crime unit's actually formed within the Edmonton police for the first time to help combat it, right, with their morality squad. So it's such an amazing story. It's great legal history. It's this sort of blend of legal history, of queer history, of sort of theatrics, and sort of what's happening in the social and sexual climate of Edmonton in the 1940s, because a lot of people don't really know what's happening in Edmonton in the 1940s, I find. No. Yeah, it's kind of sort of an unknown piece of history. So it's kind of showing how this city's developing, this trajectory, and wow, it turns out there's a whole group. And it, and then again, it happens again in Edmonton in 1947.
Wow.
Another homosexual ring bust, I say, quote unquote. So Edmonton's queer history, there's a lot. And it's really understudied, and I'm so fascinated by it.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of the references that you make are to places where we've done research, but there's things that are just happening all around North America, that the queer history of various cities like Toronto and San Francisco can apply to our understanding of the past in Western Canada. And
And the one thing that I will say, and that I do find frustrating as a historian of Western Canada, really, is just how much emphasis is placed on that bi-coastal. It's either Vancouver, Toronto, maybe Montreal if you're lucky, and that's it. And people will use those locations to talk about Canadian history. And that's just not true. I mean, we're regionally siloed emotionally, psychologically, physically, but, and some of it's not fair, but some of it really is. There really are unique experiences to the region. You can't extrapolate that. So I think it's really important that Edmonton and Calgary and Saskatoon and Regina and Winnipeg and the interior British Columbia and up north, you know, that those stories are collected and told and found, because they're there. Like I've found snippets of every location you can imagine. It'll just be hard to sort of put it together for like a larger article, but at the very least, the sources are there if you dig. It takes a lot of time and resources, right? And those can be hard to come by, but there's some really fascinating stuff there.
Absolutely. Well, Candace, I think that you've captured a lot of it. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that that you think that, you know, that should be said?
I just have one thing to add, and that's that, you know, and it's my own personal frustration, and I know my supervisor's frustration with queer history in general, is there is heavy male focused. And we really want to get away from that as much as possible, because trans people and I should say a cis male focus, because trans people and lesbians, queer people, two-spirit people have just have existed just alongside as men. It's just harder to find them, because the reason why we men are so heavily focused is because they're often unable to escape the law, right? In ways that other people can sort of circumvent that. But, you know, I guess if people are inspired at all to do queer history, I really recommend trying to find women, at the very least, include them, because there's been too many queer histories that I've read where it's essentially just a gay male history. Right. And it's important to tell those stories. It's not that that's not important, but it would just be really great that when we talk about queer history, we mean everybody that's mm-hmm. in the rainbow alphabet, you know, like all of us. And that's sort of, I guess, my 2 cents.
That is great. And I think a good 2 cents.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that 2 cents. That's really good. Hey, listen, Candace, thanks for doing this today. We really super appreciate it. It's really interesting to hear about, you know, these things that I don't think that, you know, that people know enough about. And hopefully through our digging into it, that people will be able to educate themselves a little bit.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.